All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. Musician Bryan Adams, the Grammy Award-winning artist who issued his platinum-selling album Reckless, featuring hit records Summer of 69, Heaven, Run to You, Somebody, and countless top-charting hits over the years, along with the iconic Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, have teamed up for a summer tour stocked with their biggest hits, and they're playing this Sunday, July 2nd, at the Allstate Arena. And we welcome Bryan Adams back to the program. Welcome in, Bryan.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. I wanted to step back a little bit and talk about how you got into music to begin with. You know, I know music became a big part of your life at a pretty early age, like 13, 14 years old. How did you get interested in guitars and performing and singing?
I just, when I was very young, I just wanted to play guitar, or actually I really wanted to be a drummer. And my parents bought me a guitar instead. And I just picked it up and started learning how to play it. I never took any lessons, and I just would listen to my records and work it out. I had a book of chords, and I just learned how to put my fingers on the guitar, and that's how I learned how to play. So from there, it was just about mimicking and getting as close to it as I could. And then from there, just starting with bands and just playing in my basement with bands and getting other musicians that were interested as well. And it just went from one thing to the next. And for me, as a youngster, I became quite interested in not being in school.
Uh-huh.
So I just went out and joined a band and went on tour, and that was age 15. I never looked back.
You know, I love the story. You told us before that you were going to sing and play the guitar until the band found a singer, but they never found one. So you were the singer.
That's right. And I can remember one time particularly when I was with everybody in my basement, and actually it was my friend's basement, and they said, okay, well, let's do a recording. And we were recording a song. It was a Blind Faith song called Can't Find My Way Home. And who's going to sing it? And everyone went really quiet. And I said, well, I'll have a go, you know. And then I remember singing the song, and it wasn't like multi-track recording. This was like a two-track recording. And at the end of the recording, I looked around the room, and no one was saying anything. Everyone sort of looking at me. And I said, what? It's like, oh, nothing. Listen to that back, you know. And I think it was, they just had never heard my voice before. They didn't know I could sing.
Did you know you could sing at that time? I mean, did you have the confidence to do that yourself?
I don't know if I had any confidence. I just had this sort of fearlessness about it. Because I used to sing to myself when I went to school. And I would sing, as I was walking to school. And so that's sort of where I started. Just, like I said, listening to records and singing along with those. And just, just kind of mimicking it. As opposed to sort of just being trained.
Yeah.
And I was never trained.
That's cool. But that's a natural, but that's natural talent right there, which is something to be said for that. Now, I know real quick in like 1978, you signed with A&M Records. You were 19 at the time. I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I was 18, but I had come to the point where I'd been working with Jim Vallance writing songs, and he was a busy guy, and I was just a young nothing. I used to actually had borrowed money off him to get to his place because I had nothing. And bus fare.
It's so, okay. It's how you start, right?
I got a deal, and I managed to get a deal based on the demos that we had. We'd made some recordings in his basement. And based on those recordings, I managed to, to scramble a sort of record contract together. I mean, it was a terrible deal, but it was a foot in, and it was an opportunity to prove myself. And I always had this feeling like, okay, well, even if I sign this terrible contract, at least if things go well, we'll be able to change it later. I'm still signed to that deal today.
Well, I was going to say though, when you're 18 years old, trying to get your name out there and put yourself on the map, you do those things though, and you know, and once you find that success, you're kind of paying it forward to yourself a little bit. That once you find that success, then you know the better contracts and so forth will come your way. But that's the only way to really kick yourself off and get started is getting your foot in the door.
I don't know how I had the balls to do that, but that's how I started.
Yeah, and I know there was a couple songs you know recorded early on that became part of your first album. And I also know you recorded a disco hit. It was Let Me Take You Dancing that right. You did at that time. Is that something, did you do that because that was kind of what was happening right now in the music scene? Or was your heart always with rock and roll?
We had made a bunch of demos. That record actually was made for us. You know, my demo actually is a lot slower than that, so... it was sent to a DJ in New York, and he sped it up, and that's you know, that's how that record. But that's, you know, early. That's a long time ago.
Now, your first album came out in '80. You Want It, You Got It came out soon after in '81. Then came Cuts Like a Knife, which included, you know, the hit Straight from the Heart. Would you say that album put you on the map? I mean, Reckless really just threw you out there, but was Cuts Like a Knife the one that really made you a household name?
I look at You Want It, You Got It, which was the second album, Cuts Like a Knife, which was the third album, and Reckless, the fourth album. It's kind of a trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
They were the records that I made with Bob Clearmountain and Jim Vallance, and it was kind of like being on a little bit of a treadmill. I'd write and record and go on tour, and then write and record and go on tour, then write and record and go on tour. And it was like Groundhog Day, and we just kept doing it. And as the tours continued, and as the concerts, you know, we were getting better and better reception, I kind of felt as though there was kind of a groundswell starting that, you know, even from the early days of opening up for bands like Foreigner and the Kinks.
Sure.
Those early days were formative in being able to just be able to know what direction I was going to go. And so when I would come back from tour, I would say, you know, I think I need a song like this, or I need to do a song like that, or I had these little ideas, and I would sort of put the puzzle together in the studio with Jim, and then go and record it with Clear Mountain. And all those records were recorded in New York and in Vancouver, and they have a similar sound to them. And there's just something about when I look back on those albums, that trilogy of records is, you know, that was the thing that those were sort of my groundbreaking, you know, cornerstone records.
And but also at that time it was MTV too. I mean, that was the other thing. You know, MTV was just hitting. Hitting homes, and you know, to be a part of that in the beginning had to propel things as well.
I'm not sure how much MTV was accessible to everybody in the very, very early days, because not everybody had cable television. Mm-hmm. And so in the very, very early days it was exciting because it was all starting to happen. More people were getting hooked into this thing, and there was there seemed to be a propulsion of music television as well. You know, from there it went,
sure,
to VH1. There was all kinds of stuff that was going on, and people were hooking into it because there wasn't an alternative like there is today, where you can just go on the internet. You know, if anybody wanted to hear a record, you had to go on and listen to your radio station. So to suddenly have a visual connection other than television, because television was never going to play, you know, rock videos. There was no future.
No form for it, yeah.
So, you know, for the kids to find out that there was an avenue out there that was exciting and young and was speaking to them, you know, everybody went to it, and it became popular because it was the only avenue that gave people an alternative from television and radio.
Well, and I say, then came Reckless, you know, which sold 12 million copies, and that's what you're celebrating on this tour, 30 years. And six singles released from the album: Run to You, Somebody, Heaven, Summer of 69, One Night Love Affair, It's Only Love. All six singles made the top 15 on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100. a feature at that time that had been only accomplished by Michael Jackson's Thriller, Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA. That must have blown your mind.
Yeah, at the time it was all very quick, and it had all happened so fast that really in reflection it was only I was able to appreciate it. At the time of it all happening, it was a real whirlwind, and there was no way of being able to catch up. I mean, and furthermore, there was no real access to knowing chart positions unless I called somebody. And so I was just on tour and working it, and half the time away, you know, I did a tour with Tina Turner, and that helped break Europe. So there was all this other stuff going on around the world. Reckless became a global record.
Well, we're talking to Grammy Award-winning rock musician Bryan Adams, and there's much more ahead on 720 WGN.
Day player on 720 WGN. We're talking to rock icon Bryan Adams. Now, Run to You was released as a single from Reckless, and then you got the legendary Tina Turner to sing with you on It's Only Love. Did you always have Tina in mind for the song?
Tina was being produced by a guy called Carter, and Carter and I had made some records together for a band called Prism, and Jim and I had written the songs for them. And so Carter wrote to me and said, hey, will you write me a song for Tina Turner? And I was in the middle of making Reckless, and I was like, wow, I'd absolutely love to do that. I have a song that might be really great, which she'd be interested in singing on my record. And didn't hear back. And then, coincidentally, just before we were mixing the record, I heard that she was coming to town. She was the support act for Lionel Richie, and she was playing in Vancouver at the time. And so I sent a copy of the song to her manager, and got a call back and said, "Listen, Tina would like to meet you." I said, wow! So I went down to the gig, and she'd finished playing, and I just remember this mane of hair coming down the hallway, and I could hear her going, "Where is he? Where is he?" And I was stood there by the door, and someone said, "There he is." And he said, "Brian, I love this song, you know." And so and I said, "Great, can you come and record it tomorrow?" And she said, "I can't." And so we recorded it, and it was one of those moments in the studio where I recorded the song for myself in my register, and hadn't really thought about it being a duet. I mean, it was one of the things we had to try. So when we first started it, she was trying to sing at my register, and it wasn't working. So I went out there and just sort of sang with her and just said, you know, just go for me, sing it up here. And I started singing at her, and then she started singing back to me, and that was it. It was just
wow. Fire.
And by the time she left the studio, I remember going back in, and it was like, you know, that moment where like there's been like a huge gust of wind has opened.
Yeah, what I think is pretty surreal. Yeah, exactly.
You know, like a gust of wind has blown open the front door, and it's just like, and you don't know what's hit you, and then you go back and you close the door and you look around the room like, okay, what fell over? And it was kind of like that moment. And I said, I really hope you ever got that on tape.
And, yeah, me too. I'm sure.
I got it, and we played it back, and it was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, she truly elevated that song. Had it not had her performance on it, I really don't think that song would have had much of a life, because it was, to me, it was
powerful.
It's so needed to have the connection of two people on it. And so my utmost respect and gratitude to her for making that song come alive, because she really did.
I bet. You know, I've heard you talk about this before. I have to bring this up. Most people believe that the summer of 69, which is such a summer anthem, still to this day, to listen to, it wasn't really about the year. It's not about the summer of 1969. Tell us what your interpretation is of this song.
Well, the song is it's really about you know, it's a song about regret and loss of innocence, and it's the broken promise of youth. But it's also about finding out about what love is, and it's about the 69 reference is very much about, you know,
sex.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was never about a particular year, because it was, you know, it was about looking back on moments in my life, or you know, moan back to, in anyone's life, on a summer where you discovered yourself.
Sure.
And you discovered what it was like to be in a sexual relationship.
Yeah, it's an interesting way how you put that. Is it's a recognition of a life change and a loss of innocence. That's a really great way of putting that.
Yeah, and it's about discovering also. You're losing one thing, but you're gaining something else. You're learning about yourself. And it's about, you know, looking back on good times and discovering sex.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And I'm sure that's why that song is memorable to a lot of people, especially those who grew up that year and heard that song, that there was probably a connection for them as well.
In fact, one of the songs on the record is called Reckless, and it was written at the very last minute when I guess I decided I was going to call the album Reckless. I thought, well, let's write a song called Reckless. And so we wrote this song, but because of time constrictions, we didn't put it on the record. We didn't re-record it. However, I should have just put the demo out, because the demo is, you know, if you've got the repackaged version there, you should listen to it, because that song should have been on the album. It's one of the only regrets I have on the record.
Brian, thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight, and enjoy your time in Chicago.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
Same here, Brian. Take care.
See ya.
All right. 720 WGN.